Today's Taisho will be on case 10 in the Blue Rock Collection, Yiyen Lu, the Hikigan Roku. Case 10 is entitled Bokushu's Empty-Headed Fool. Engo's introduction. Yes is yes, no is no. In the Dharma battle, each stands his own ground. Therefore, it is said, when one's activity is upward, even Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, the thousand holy ones, and the teachers of the whole world become spiritless and silent. When one's activity is downward, even maggots, gnats, and all creatures become brilliantly illuminating and as independent as a 10,000-foot cliff. However, how is it when one's activity is neither upward nor downward? If there is any rule, rely on the rule. If there's no rule, follow a precedent. See the following. Bokushu asked the monk, "Where are you from?" The monk gave a "Katz" shout. Bokushu said, "This old monk is shouted down by you." The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, "What about the third and fourth shouts?" The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, "You empty-headed fool." Setchu's verse. Two shouts, three shouts. The knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Expose him to the world. Last night, I talked about this discourse that the Buddha delivered, and in the discourse, one of the things he said was that if you go down to the ocean and you taste the water in the ocean, it just has one flavor, salty. And the Buddha said, if you taste my Dharma, my teaching, my way, it just has one taste, freedom. I love that little story because I think it's absolutely the case that we're practicing a way which is really an amazing way of life, really beautiful and liberating on many levels. And this is the first day of a process that people go through, process, you could say, of liberating ourselves from our entanglements. And this is a challenging day, of course, for many people. But everybody's come here for the sashimi, and because I think you've tasted that freedom and want a little more of it. And so today is, we're starting out on this journey to that freedom. And everybody is doing a good job. I want to thank everybody for making an excellent effort. I meant it when I was complimenting Jeff on practicing while he's sick. I myself have been sick at many sashimis, and it's not particularly fun to be sick. You know? When we come to sashin, we would like to be, myself included, in tip-top form, because it is strenuous, So when we come to sashin, we would like to be, well rested, good health, and yet often that's not the case. And a couple of people did call me this time, and just said, "Listen, I'm getting sick. I'm not sure I'm going to be there, and I'm not I understand, you know, they might be so wiped out. I mean, I myself have been, you know, so wiped out sometime that I couldn't get out of bed, you know. Fortunately, that's never happened to me at Sesshin so far, but probably someday it will, and I don't know how I'll deal with the experience, you know. But it takes great courage, even though you're sick, to come to Sesshin, great determination. And it takes great determination to sit on the cushion and keep working with your practice, with your koan, even though you're not in your top form, and you have a sore throat, or you might be running a fever, or your head is pounding, and so on and so on, you know. However, you know, even though nobody likes to be sick, myself included, if you keep practicing, there is a condition of awareness in which it will no longer matter that you're sick. And that's not an abstract formulation, it's absolutely true. I used to get sick all the time at Sesshin. And I would just be like clockwork. I would come to Sesshin and I used to get cold sores. I don't know if you know what cold sores are, but some people have a herpes infection, which is probably picked up when you're a little kid. And when your immune system is taxed, you begin to have especially on your lips sometimes your other parts of the face, but usually around the lips, you get a big blister, big sore, you know. And it would just be like every Sesshin, it would be like clockwork, and I would get this big sore, and I'd be sick, I'd have a fever. And in fact, you know, when I had my Great Awakening experience many years ago, I was having many problems, including our group was going through financial problems that eventually cost us the temple we had built. We had to sell it. But in addition to that, I was very sick. I think I must have had dysentery because I came up to the we were arriving at our temple early before Sesshin started. In order to get everything ready, it was very rustic, very up in the mountains. It was about 2.5 hours away from Seattle, and it was in a breathtaking place. But we had to draw water by hand. And one of the jobs at the Sesshin was fetching water, and you know, basically, we would bring up a water barrel on a truck. And there was a very nice mountain stream where we had put a pipe in the stream bed, and the water would come out very clear and cold through the pipe, and then we would take the buckets and fill the barrel on the back of a truck, and then take it over to the kitchen, and we would fill many barrels like that for cooking and washing. We didn't have any plumbing. And we had outhouses, you know. So anyway, I got there a day or two before the Sesshin in order to help get everything ready, and I was actually the first one there. So I wasn't thinking very clearly, and I was in the kitchen, and I took the top off of one of the barrels, and I had a big glass of water, and I didn't think anything of it. And then later my friend John Sunston came, and John is at that time I was a graduate student, but John is a professor in the medical school. And John arrived maybe half a day after I did, and we were in the kitchen, and he looked at the barrels, and he looked inside and he said, "You didn't drink out of these, did you?" Well, it was too late. So I said, "No." Who would be stupid enough to do that, right? Of course not, you know. Because he said, they're probably full of amoebas by now, you know, there's, and so we emptied it out. And indeed, I got incredibly sick. Nobody likes to be sick, but if you continue with determination, you won't be disappointed, because there really is a state of awareness in which it won't matter. And the more time you spend there, the better you will be in your life, in my opinion. This is a story about two awakened people who encounter each other. So the first one is Bokushu. Bokushu is a Zen master who was a contemporary of Linji. In fact, he was also a disciple of, also a student of Wangbo or Obaku. And so he would have been like Linji's brother, Dharma brother. A monk came to see Bokushu, and Bokushu said to him, "Where are you from?" See, this is a, if you ever go to another Zen place and somebody says, "Where are you from?" or the teacher says, "Where are you from?" it might be a Zen question. And it really wants to ask, where is your mind now? Yeah, where's your mind coming from? Where is your awareness at this moment coming from? Have you seen the source of your own awareness? Have you seen the roots of your own consciousness? And indeed, have you seen the source of everything? The monk gives a shout. Now that's a wonderful answer, because he's demonstrating his mind. He isn't, you know, it's the same thing with Joshu's Mu. If some of you are doing the Mu koan, a monk asked Master Joshu, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" Now if Joshu had said, that's a very interesting question. See? And he said, "You know, actually, everything has Buddha nature. And even though we think of a dog as lowly, yes, even a lowly dog has Buddha nature." So if Joshu said that, actually Joshu would not have been the great Zen master. And in fact, if everybody in Zen gave answers like that, Zen would be a total fraud and not worth doing. Because that kind of an answer is not liberating. It actually is deeply ensnared in the realm of ideas, and which aren't real. So basically, what Joshu does, instead of saying, "Well, now there's an interesting question," you know, instead of saying, "Well, in the sutra, Buddha says blah blah blah, therefore the dog," instead he that is not the way of the Buddha, you know, to rely on words and ideas. Words and ideas arise from a deeper place. See, they arise from a deeper place, and what we're doing when we meditate is to return to that deeper place. There's something more fundamental than words and ideas. Words and ideas can only exist in a world that already has life and a coherence of its own. See, I mean, one of the interesting things is that even if you're mistaken in one of your ideas, the world doesn't stop being the world, because it already exists long before you formed an opinion about it, and it will exist long after. There's something about the world which is bigger and more profound and more real than our ideas about it. And this is a fortunate thing. But when we humans tend to get so caught up in our ideas and our thoughts and our philosophies and our worries and our desires and our dreams, that we don't see the real coherence of the world. We don't encounter the real life of things. And so Zen is all about returning to the source, returning to the root, you could say. There's something more fundamental than the labels we apply to things. There's some kind of a coherence which is more coherent than any system we've ever managed to develop to explain the world. You know, physicists have been arguing for the last 15 or 20 years about something called string theory. You know, one of the most curious things is that, around the turn of the last century, a lot of physicists believed there was nothing smaller than a molecule. And then they discovered, they came up with a theory of atoms, and they actually discovered, they could find a way to prove the existence of atoms. And for a while they thought the atom was the smallest thing in the universe, that everything was built out of atoms. But then lo and behold, they discovered that atoms had parts too. And you might remember those from high school, you know, proton and electron and so on, and neutrons and so on. And they thought, well there, that's the smallest thing in the universe. But then they discovered other kinds of particles which were very weird, you know, which were even smaller than those. And so far nobody's ever been able to find the smallest particle or the smallest. Now there's a theory that there's something called strings, that the particles, the subatomic particles that make up the atom are actually made up of tiny little vibrating strings. They look like SpaghettiOs, if you ate SpaghettiOs, and only some of them are bent over like an infinity sign. And there's like a couple different shapes. Some of them are sort of like a smile, right, with two lips. And of course, scientists have been studying this for 15 years, and they've been arguing about the shapes of the strings. But recently, a bunch of scientists have come along and said, you know, I don't think these strings are really there. I don't think they exist. So the strings, there may not be any strings. There might be something even smaller than strings. And, you know, we might never get to the smallest thing. But the interesting thing is that even though even though our string theory may have failed, the universe is still here. There's some kind of coherence to the universe. There's something about the presence of the universe which is bigger than all of our attempts to understand it. And one way to look at it is we'll just never know, you know. And intellectually that's true, but we have this deeper intelligence. We have a bigger mind than the let's face it. I mean, the guys who came up with string theory are very smart people, you know. I mean, much smarter than I am. And they are so smart, I'm told. A friend of mine works at Princeton, and he's an engineer at Princeton, and he says some of the physicists in the department routinely forget where they park their cars and have to call the campus police. Really. These guys get to work and they spend all day immersed in their string theory, and then they come out and they can't remember where they live, you know, and stuff like that. Really. So they're very smart, you know. I myself have trouble finding my car, but for a different reason, you know. So the point is, very smart people, but the truth is we have even ordinary people like myself have a super intelligence that these very brilliant people don't know how to tap often. And you don't have to have a PhD from Princeton, and having one might not help you, because we have this other kind of intelligence which doesn't work with symbols, and words, but can understand or can encounter, maybe I should say, encounter reality in a very profound way. And that's what Zen practice is about. When we sit on the cushion, the goal is to activate this deeper intelligence, which is a connective kind of intelligence. It's instead of trying to break things into smaller and smaller pieces, it's kind of like the whole picture intelligence. There's a kind of intelligence that doesn't see things in isolated pieces, but experiences things as they all fit together. And this is the intelligence we're activating when we sit on the cushion. So, basically, when you have these two Zen masters encountering each other, it's one teacher meeting an unfamiliar monk and saying to the monk, well, have you learned how to activate that intelligence? And the monk says, "Khats," when he says, "What is the question is, where are you from? Where are you from? Show me the source. Have you been to the source?" And the monk could say, "Ah, the source. Yes, of course. You know, everything is one. You know, it's all one. You know." But like the Joshu, he doesn't do that. He doesn't give that kind of an answer. He acts from his, what we call his big mind, acts from his big mind. So when a monk asks Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature, Joshu could give him an explanation using words and ideas, but instead he says, "Moo." In other words, he says, follow this path, and it will take you to the source. It follows, it will take you to this big mind, this source mind. Yeah. And so basically Joshu acts in a way that shows this person, this monk, how to get there, instead of giving him words and ideas that would only be an obstacle. Okay, so in this case, Bokushu says to this unfamiliar monk, "Where are you from?" In other words, have you found that kind of intelligence? And if the monk had said, "Oh yes, it's a big mind," he said, "It's a big mind, and it's not the discriminating mind," and so on, he wouldn't have it. What he does instead is to act from. He's so deeply in that awareness that he acts directly out of it. See? He acts directly from it. He's so deeply in that awareness that he, when he acts, it's an expression of his mind, his awakened mind. And he just says, "Khats," which is like a, I don't know, there's nothing like it in English, but he could have just said "nuts," you know. And so that sounds like a good answer, but Bokushu isn't sure, right? He wants to really make sure. So the monk says "cuts," and Bokushu says, "That's a pretty good answer." In other words, he says, "This old monk," meaning me, "has been shouted down by you." Yeah. And then the monk shouted again. So in other words, the monk says to Bokushu, "I don't care what you think of me, and I don't care what opinion you've reached about my shout. See, because I'm really free. I'm free from that." So then Bokushu pushes it a little farther. Bokushu says, "What about, okay, that's, you've given two shouts. What about the third and fourth shout? Let me hear those." And the monk doesn't respond. See, the monk's mind is in a special place. And Bokushu knows this by the end of this encounter, and he says, "You empty-headed fool." Now in Zen, please remember that when somebody says something like that, it's a compliment. To be an empty-headed fool is really a very difficult achievement. And it's what we're trying to do here. That you can't activate the big mind unless you can be an empty-headed fool. So you want to sit on the cushion with your back straight, watching your breath, and all kinds of ideas and thoughts are going to parade through your head, and you might think about maybe something you left behind at home. Maybe your car needs to be repaired. When I was, I have an old car which I just love. In fact, I was driving down here and I didn't have exact change, so I went into the booth on the Garden State. I went chose the booth that gives you change, you know. And I drove up and this guy came out of the booth and he looked at my car and he said, "Great car!" Yeah. And I said, "Huh?" And he said, "I have one of these. It's got 300,000 miles on it," or something like that. You know? I said, "Yeah, this is a great car." You know, and he's right. And I love my car. It has 200,000, so I guess I have another 100,000. But the shock absorbers are going on it, you know. And when I got it all loaded up for the session, I noticed that my back tire, the back tire, the rim, tire sits inside there's a place in the car. I don't even know how that works, but the chassis was so low that it was concealing the top of the wheel. So in other words, my shock absorber, my struts were so bad that when I weighted down the car, the wheel was not touching the top of the wheel well, but there was about, maybe 4 inches. You know, and it should be quite, you know, you should be able to see the whole wheel. The top of the wheel shouldn't be hidden by part of the chassis. So as I was driving down the Garden State Parkway, I was thinking, boy, I hope I make it, you know. I hope my car, my tires don't, if I see smoke coming up from the back, I'll know that my tires are hitting the wheel well. I worried about it all the way down here. And I'm going to have to go back and talk to my car repair guys and see how much it would be to replace the struts. But, when I sat down last night on the cushion, I didn't give this a moment's thought. And I won't think about it again until after the session, because I'm just going to enter that empty-headed state, and I'm not going to worry about it at all. My wife and I are putting new windows in our house because the windows we have are 80 years old and they're literally falling apart. When we bought the house, they were quite deteriorated, and this was about 13 or 14 years ago. I actually spent like 3 summers fixing the windows. And I'm actually a pretty handy carpenter. So I took the windows there, I took the windows off the casements so they open outward instead of sliding up and down. And some of them were so rotted, they sell epoxy and you can chip away the rotted wood and you can make a little frame and pour the epoxy in it. It makes a new, it replaces the deteriorated wood very well. But it only lasts so long, and then the rest of the wood is deteriorating. So now the windows have gotten to the point where whenever you close them, I wonder if the glass is just going to fall out into the yard. You know? So they really need to be replaced. And of course, we went ahead and contracted with somebody, and this is a classic. If you say, how much is this going to cost? The guy gives you an estimate, and then you go to the bank and you can take a loan. And we've been saving for this, but we still had to borrow some money. and we're certainly not hurting or anything, but it's a classic case, right? The guy's an honest guy, he's an excellent person, but he came back and said, oh, listen, it's going to be a little more than we thought, right? So he said, uh-oh, you know. And so, you know, we were concerned about that this week, but I'm not going to give it a moment's thought, like a sashin. I'm going to let it go, and I'm going to sit as like an empty-headed fool. And I have other concerns, just as you do, you know. There's problems on my job. I've been writing this book, you know, that I spent 2 years on. And that's a short time for me. My last book took about 5 years. And one of my friends is the book agent. And so far it's been turned down by a couple of presses. So it's just possible, you know, every press will turn it down. You know, and I'll put it in the drawer. You know, and that would be kind of heartbreaking, right? I mean, I worked on that for a couple of years, and I put a lot of my energy and love into it. But it could happen, you know, it could just go in the drawer. That happens, you know, people write novels and books and they can't find a publisher, you know. And you think, oh my God, I've spent 3 years or 2 years on this, five years on this project. But, you know, it'll eat you up if you let it. But I'm just going to let it go. I'm not going to give it a moment's thought. I'm just going to be an empty-headed fool. I think that's a wonderful way to live, you know. I'm going to come in. I came in last night and I sat down on the cushion and I watched my breath and I entered Mushin. And that beautiful rain was falling, yes? And it was heaven. It was just heaven. Now, I can't make a publisher accept my book. I can't control the cost of the remodeling of my house. If the state of New Jersey has a massive budget cut next year and cuts my program that I've worked for 25 years to build up, it cuts it severely by like a quarter of the budget, I might have a very difficult year next year. I might have to lay off people who have worked with me for 10 years. And that would be a really difficult experience. Very, very hard. I hope I don't have to do that. And that would be one of the sadder days of my life, I guess. But I'm not going to think about it, because there's nothing I can do about it right now, and I'm going to be an empty-headed fool. You know, all of these problems in life, you know, can really wear away at you, and they can really cripple you. You know, we all have dreams and aspirations, and of course everybody has plans. All the people who we're involved with in life want us to do this or to do that. And we can get very, very trapped in ways of life that don't allow us to be free. One person was planning to come to the retreat, to the sashin, but at the last minute can't come because of work. And I understand, I feel so sorry for that person, because this is a person who's been trying to get the sashin almost for a year, and that something always comes up, and it may be the person's just procrastinating, you know, but it may be the person's really trapped and can't come to sashin, and basically the average person just has to spend every day, every night with these fears and these anxieties, these worries, these disappointments. I think there's just something so wonderful and so special about being able to step out of all that and be and experience life in a bigger way. I know that when I go back to my job, when I go back to my house, and when I go back to my book, and so on and so on, I'm going to be able to deal with it much better, because I haven't been a prisoner of all these things, you know. So I think Zen is really this wonderful opportunity to be free, and it's not running from life. See, I don't think this is running from life. I think this is embracing life. I think we live in too small a way. We create all of these artificial, you know. I mean, the truth is, you know, if my book never gets into print, it doesn't matter. It doesn't. It matters to me because I put two or three years into it. But you know, even if it's the greatest book that's ever written, people are going to read it once and put it in the bookcase, right? And basically, it's not going to make that big a difference to the universe, you know? I mean, I always upset people in my field because, you know, in English, if you say the name Shakespeare, people, it's like saying the word God to religious people, right? You say, and then there's Shakespeare, and everybody just sort of goes, oh, Shakespeare, you know, he's the peak, right? And yet I often say, you know, the day will come when nobody even knows who Shakespeare is. See? And, oh, people get so upset. It's like, you monster. Mm-hmm. But you know it's true. You know it's true. So, you know, even Shakespeare is going to be forgotten someday. But Shakespeare will be gone, but there'll be something that is still here. It's bigger than Shakespeare. I really believe that. You know, it's bigger than Shakespeare. It's bigger than success. The mind we enter, it's a sheen, is bigger than success or failure. It's bigger than fame or obscurity. It's bigger than wealth or poverty. It's bigger, and so on. It's bigger than all of those things. It includes all of those things, but it's bigger than all of that. It's bigger than health and sickness. Yeah. And you experience it when you sit on the cushion and your mind becomes blank for maybe just a split second. Yes, that mind, that empty mind. But you know, if you stay there long enough, the strangest thing happens to you. You become so calm and happy. You feel so connected, such joy, such freedom. You know, and you feel so rejuvenated and so young, you know. It's like being restored to youth. I mean, you're pretty young, so that's not much of a sales pitch because you're pretty young. But, when I'm on the cushion and I'm in Mushin, I feel like I could run a marathon. Now, I can't, but I could once, you know. But I feel so alive. I feel so alive, so young, you know. So please be calm and empty-headed fool. You know, don't let anything get in the way of your freedom. Just sit on the cushion and focus on your breath and focus on Mu Shi and call your koan. Don't worry about success or failure. Don't worry about answering your koan. Just be with your koan wholeheartedly. You know, have no expectations whatsoever. And if you live this way, it will have the most wonderful, you'll have the most wonderful life. You know, Bodhidharma, I'll wrap it up, but Bodhidharma came to China from India. Great Zen, great meditation master from India. And he met the Emperor of China, and the Emperor of China could have helped him, you know. If he had impressed the Emperor of China, the Emperor of China would have built him a beautiful temple and, gotten maybe nice meditation hall with beautiful paneling, whatever, you know. Good kitchen, nice cook, good cooks in the kitchen for sesshin, you know. But Bodhidharma would have been famous, etc., etc. All the nobility would have met Bodhidharma, people would have thrown flowers at him and stuff. You know. But he has an interview with the Emperor of China, and it's a disaster. It's like the job interview from hell, right? And so Bodhidharma goes up into the mountains, and he finds a cave, and he just sits in the cave, and he becomes an empty-headed fool. He faces the blank wall of the cave. People think it's the blank wall of the cave. In Chinese, this is called piquan, sitting, staring at the wall. He stares at the wall for 9 years, and three people eventually show up to become his students, two men and a woman. They're the founders of Zen in China. The point is, though, that Bodhidharma didn't care, because he lived a bigger life. And he sat in front of the wall and encountered, we say, true nature, big mind. And there was no sense of disappointment or a failure or dissatisfaction, because it's like living 100% of life, 100% encounter with life, you know? So we're here for a 100% encounter for life, and what gets in the way, however, is all of those expectations, those fears, those dreams, those insecurities, etc. So we have to do some sitting. We have to work through our karmic obstacles. But you know, you will. You just keep coming back to your breath and coming back to your breath and coming back to Mu, and you will return to your natural state, which is at home in the world. Beautiful. And that's what we're here to do. So some of you may be sick, some of you may be well, you know, some of you may have a million worries back in town, but please, this is your chance to live a life bigger than our worries, yeah? Bigger than our worries. And it's so necessary, it's so restorative and liberating. People go crazy because they don't know how to get to this place. They become alcoholics, they become manic depressive, really. I mean, my wife came home the other night and she said to me, "My God, I know so many people who are on antidepressants." And I said, I do too, now that you mention it. One of my best friends at work is on antidepressants. My sister's on antidepressants. Another person I know is on, you know, so I feel terribly sad that these people don't know how to get out of their small mind. Yeah? And they just, people can sit for 40 years and eat your heart out. Yeah? Because something hasn't happened the way you wanted it to happen. And if that's how you want to live, by all means, you know, free country. But this is a different way of living. It's like living 100% in a joyous freedom. So please, be an empty-headed fool. Pay no attention to anything except your koan, except that blankness. Let the whole world disappear. It doesn't matter. Just be in that blankness, and everything will be wonderful. Bokushu asked a monk, "Where are you from?" Great question, right? The monk gave a cuts shout. Bokushu said again, "This old monk is shouted down by you." The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, "What about the third and fourth shouts?" The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, "You empty-headed fool." Two shouts, three shouts. The knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Goes into the world. Please be blind, be deaf, dumb, go face the wall of Mu. Okay? And everything will come alive. Everything will come alive.